United States versus Vickers. Mr. Pleasant.
Good morning, Your Honors. Mark Pleasant on behalf of Matthew Vickers. The prosecutor in this case made improper statements which caused into question the verdict in this case. As we all know, a prosecutor cannot express to the jury their personal opinions concerning the credibility of witnesses.
But didn't he just point out inconsistencies? I mean, he's allowed to do that.
Yes, the prosecutor is clearly allowed to point out inconsistencies. But the prosecutor made two big statements, and I think if we look at them individually, it even makes the situation worse. The first statement intimated that Jose Santos, a witness for the defendant, was a snitch. The prosecutor said, Mr. Santos cannot tell you the truth, ladies and gentlemen, because if he tells you that Officer Craig was attacked by the defendant, then he'll get a reputation for ratting out a fellow prisoner and then will pay the price in prison. So that intimated that if Mr. Santos said that Matt Vickers struck first, he stood to get beat up in prison as being a snitch. Then the next statement intimates that Mr. Santos was committing perjury. But if he tells you that Matthew Vickers was attacked by Officer Craig, well, then he's under oath, he knows he's under oath on the stand, and he may have to spend a little more time in prison for telling you that. That's intimating perjury. So you take those two statements, especially together, in light of the evidence in this case, in light of the facts of this case, it's clearly an error. It's clearly reversible, even though it is a plain error because it was not objected to.
I'm sorry. Counsel, let me make sure I understand your understanding of what this rule is supposed to be preventing. My understanding was that a prosecutor was prohibited from suggesting to the jury that the prosecutor had secret information. I know this person is telling the truth. It seems to me, or is lying either way, it seems to me what happened here, as Judge Smith was pointing out, is that the prosecutor was analyzing what the jury should analyze and figuring out credibility. I mean, I don't see a personal opinion in what you've read so far being expressed by the prosecutor. And you did use the word intimate, which I find suggestive that it's not a very clear statement of personal opinion.
Well, I used the word intimate.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah. I think fairly so.
Yes.
Accurately so.
Well, I think, and I used the word intimate to say that she didn't come right out and say he's a snitch. If he says one way, he's committing perjury. I don't think we're limited to having to say the magic words, he's a snitch, or he's committing perjury, or, you know, he does not have credibility to make it clear to a jury or to make an improper statement to a jury that would sway the jury, especially in light of the facts of this case. And I think so, knowing that Mr. Santos clearly testified that he didn't see who threw the first punch. That was not in dispute. So she's intimating, or if that's not the right word, or strong enough word, suggesting strongly that Mr. Santos is lying or not telling the truth, when in fact, you know, he was clearly questioned. Did you actually see that? I stood there through everything. And did you see who struck the first blow in the fight? No, I did not. So he made it clear, despite his testimony, he did not. And that was a question from Mr. Vickers' own attorney. That he made it clear. Look, I'm here testifying as to what I saw occur, but I'm not here telling you that who started the fight. And except the whole case turns on credibility, because we have this great video, and it shows everything but who started the fight. The video is clearly it's lapsed. It didn't record, or because of the way the cameras were turned, and I hadn't quite figured out exactly why, but it doesn't show who struck first or the initial events that precipitated this thing. So
let me ask you on that. at least in the briefing, it sounds odd. Is there any indication that at some that they're in and outside of the camera angle, or I mean, it at least sounds, I don't want to use an improper word here, that the altercation should have been entirely on the video, and it's not. But are the actors moving in and out of the camera range, or what's the situation? Have you seen the video?
I have, and it just kind of starts. The part of the video I've seen, and again, I wasn't at the original briefing attorney, I'm sure, as you're aware, or the trial attorney, but I have seen the video, and it looks like it just starts. And if you listen to my client based on the letters he sent me, you know, it's always a conspiracy. I can't say that, Your Honor. I don't know why. I can't really answer your question. I don't know of anything in the record that clearly says they were out of camera angle, they started it late. I do know Mr. Rabelais said he saw it and he was one of the camera operators. So, you know, it could be that the camera was facing one way and then you see something with your eye and, you know, he could have been very well distracted and not turned the camera, or it could have been just out of the angle of the camera. But that's an important fact, that it was not on the camera, because, again, the case turns on credibility. We have four people who testified as to the exact events that occurred. We had Mr. Craig who testified, Mr. Rabelais who testified, and there was numerous witnesses, but those two testified as to the altercation. Obviously, Mr. Craig being the one who was struck, or who did the striking, however you're going to interpret it, Mr. Rabelais as to what he saw. And then Mr. Vickers had Mr. White and Mr. Santos. And Mr. Santos was the key witness for Mr. Vickers. And he said, I didn't see who started it, but then you have the prosecutor suggesting or telling the jury, look, you know, you really can't believe his credibility, because if he tells you one thing, he's a snitch. If he tells you the other thing, he's committing perjury. And I think this court and the appellate courts have taken strong looks at the language of prosecutors in these particular cases, because that, you know, that when the innocence hinges primarily or entirely on credibility, it becomes critical and crucial as to how far the prosecutor can go or not go. And look, certainly as the courts have said, you know, you can throw a fast pitch or a hard pitch, you just can't throw a foul pitch. And obviously, this is one where I think, you know, they've thrown a foul pitch in this case. And even if perhaps it may not rise to a overwhelming level of improper conduct, it certainly mischaracterizes the evidence. Now, granted, a defense attorney has a right to come back and finish, you know, perhaps, and maybe clear some of this up, but it clearly mischaracterizes the testimony in light of the fact that Mr. Santos clearly said, I didn't see who threw the first punch. And I think when you look at it in the totality of the case, it's clearly a reversible error, especially in light of the fact of one of the other issues brought up, and I think they go hand in hand, where the jury asked the question that, or the jury not only intimated, they suggested to the court, we have reasonable doubt. What do we do in light of the fact that there's no video? I mean, they asked clearly, does a reasonable doubt between forcible and simple assault exist, because we could not see the beginning of the altercation? Some jurors feel that it was provoked and more to it than we saw. Well, to me, some jurors feel that it was provoked. That's reasonable doubt as to the defendant committing the crime. And that goes to the lapse video. And then when the court came back and essentially gave the generic instructions of, you have all the evidence, you have the definition of reasonable doubt, and you need to go back and act accordingly. And when the jury was dismissed at 12:36, the record shows the court was informed of a verdict at 12:42. Now, in the government's brief, they said the verdict was read at such and such a time, and that's not in dispute. What I'm saying is, you got to look at what the record says when the court noted, we have a verdict, we need to bring in the jury. That was 6 minutes from the time the judge says, go back, you got everything. And obviously, we don't know what happened in those 6 minutes, but you know, obviously there's perhaps some frustration on perhaps that a jury, they're asking a question that they're telling the court, we need guidance as to reasonable doubt. We're telling you there's reasonable doubt. What do we do? And I think instead of just giving the general, advice about you have the evidence, you have the instructions, go read them. Well, judges, y'all read thousands of pages, hopefully not a day, but at least in a week. I mean, as lawyers and appellate lawyers, we read thousands of pages all the time. You know, I don't know in 6 minutes if I could go back and have read the jury instructions in light of the judge's instruction and understand them so that I can make a valid or feel that I'm doing my job as a juror in this case. Mr. Vickers' brief writing attorney cited the Bolingbach case that when a jury makes explicit its difficulties, the judge should clear those difficulties away with concrete accuracy, and give supplemental instructions. And in that case, they argued 7 hours, came to the judge and asked for instructions, went back and took less than 5 minutes. Here the government makes a point, look, you need to look at the total time the jury deliberated this case. It was an hour and 30-some-odd minutes, an hour and 40-some-odd minutes. Well, okay, fine. I think what's important is the 6 minutes. And obviously they had some doubt in light of not having the video. And to make the jump again, the lack of the video makes it clear that the only evidence is the testimony and credibility. And I think the prosecutor's statements.
One thing that struck me about this issue is that defense counsel at trial said all you ought, or what you ought to tell the jury is if they have reasonable doubt, they should vote not guilty. And then I get into reading what the judge did tell the jurors, and that's in there almost. It says, look again at the instructions carefully. They define what a reasonable doubt is. So it seems to me that the danger that the courts talk about, and the district judge is probably worried about too, is not to put undue emphasis on any single part of the instructions. And I thought the district judge was very careful. And it seems to me gave what trial counsel wanted and gave some other things too. And it seems to me that it was effective, and that's what you're saying, but I don't see that there's anything we can go on that it overrode the proper deliberations of jurors.
Well, I think when you – he gave the general instructions. He gave the pattern instructions.
And he gave what defense counsel asked for, I would say, not in exact words.
Well, I would look at it differently, Judge. I would say that he did not come out and say, if you have reasonable doubt, you must acquit. But I think the jury was, I haven't done lots of trial work and I prefer not to, but I think when a jury asks a specific question as this, they're telling you, Judge Southwick, we have reasonable doubt. Does reasonable doubt exist between the two types of crimes because we couldn't see the beginning of the altercation?
But they already had an instruction, didn't they, about what to do with reasonable doubt?
They did. They had the general jury instructions.
And at this point in the trial, the judge reiterated that you already have that instruction. And, in fact, he referenced that you should refer to the instructions which have already been given to you. Isn't that what he did?
He did.
And you contend that that was erroneous.
I contend that it was not sufficient enough. I'm not saying it's erroneous instruction. I'm saying it wasn't enough in light of the nature of their question. And I'm saying you look at the totality of circumstances. They go back and 6 minutes later, unless someone in that jury room is just, speed reader, or the little guy on, Criminal Minds who can read 20,000 words a minute. I mean, I just don't see how you could have gone back and digest what the judge said and followed his instruction to read again the instructions that define reasonable doubt and what to do if you had a reasonable doubt. And I think when you look at it in the totality of the circumstances, I'm not saying the instructions he gave was improper. I'm saying the instructions he gave was insufficient. So, in light of these errors, especially in light of the prosecutor's statements, which does rise to the level of plain error, I would respectfully submit that this case should be reversed and a new trial granted to Mr. Vickers. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Plaisance. You've saved time for rebuttal.
I did 5 minutes.
Yeah. Ms. Cossier?
Good morning, Your Honors. I would like to address first the prosecutorial statements at the end of the trial. The first thing the court has to determine is whether they were improper, and they were not improper, simply because the prosecutor referred to specific evidence, specific testimony, and specific instances in the videos that supported a consideration by the jury as to who to believe and who not to believe. With respect to Santos, he said he did not see who threw the first punch, but the video shows that he should have been able to see who threw the first punch because he was right there. He said in his testimony that he couldn't see it because he was bending down to pick up a radio. The video shows that he didn't bend down until the fight was in full swing. Secondly, he said he was picking up a radio. The government put on and asked him specifically several times in cross-examination, you were picking up the radio, and he said it two or three times. But in rebuttal, the government put on the testimony of one of the guards who said that Santos told him he had picked up a watch. So his testimony differed from two specific instances, and the government can call that to the jury's attention. The judge has just instructed the jury, and that was also important. The jury instructions were read to the jury before the attorneys gave their closing arguments. So the jury already had the instruction as to how to analyze credibility, and the jury already had the instruction that lawyers' arguments are not evidence for them to consider, but simply for them to give their views on how the jury should consider the evidence. So the arguments that the prosecutor made were entirely appropriate and proper and supported by the evidence that was presented at trial.
How would you define the category of argument that we're dealing with now that is improper? How do we know it when we see it? What must we see in the argument to know that it's improper?
What you must see is I think you have to see it in terms of first person. If the prosecutor is speaking in the first person, I think, or I believe, or I'm telling you, that's bordering on, or that is very close to being a vouching, that's my opinion, and I want you to believe that.
So whereas the prosecutor, I'm sorry, counsel, but the prosecutor can't say, I believe Santos is lying. The prosecutor can say Santos is lying?
I think the prosecutor can say the evidence will show. The testimony you heard indicates that Santos cannot be telling the truth. Can also say, with regard to bias, Santos has every reason, and that is what the prosecutor did in this case, has every reason to not see. And the reason he didn't see was because no matter which way he saw, he was going to be in trouble with somebody.
So long as there's no equivalent to I believe, the argument's all right?
I that's just a kind of a rule of thumb. I think, Your Honor, it's a case-by-case analysis, and it has to be looked at individually with respect to the length. There are many factors. With the length of the argument, I think if an attorney in closing argument makes a couple of comments like that, but it's an hour's closing argument and only two or three lines of that, if it's not on something that is really crucial and important or is the only testimony on the topic, I think that could be harmless error if it's error at all. There are just a lot of factors that go in it, into the decision. The statement in defendant's brief that a prosecutor can never make reference to the credibility of a witness is incorrect, and Robles Pantoja and Laurie and a number of cases allow the prosecutor to make comments about the credibility of witnesses based on what the judge is going to instruct them or has already instructed them about how to gauge credibility and bias. With respect to the second issue, which is in regard to the supplemental jury charge, I think I put in my brief that one way of looking at this is the jury deliberated for a little over an hour before they sent out their question. This trial lasted barely over a day. They deliberated for a little over an hour, sent out this question. I think that they had already decided what the verdict was based on the evidence that had been presented. But someone in the jury, or perhaps in an abundance of caution, the jurors thought, let's make sure that there's nothing more to this tape, that there's no additional evidence that we can go on to determine this self-defense theory that the defendant has put up. And so they came back looking for more evidence. As soon as the judge told them, there is no more evidence, look at the instructions that I have given you, and no one claims that those instructions were deficient in any way. They were perfectly fine instructions. The jury went back. They had already looked at the instructions. There was no more evidence. Based on the evidence they had, they were able to convict.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Cassier.
Thank you.
Mr. Plaisance, you've saved time for rebuttal.
Very briefly. The government says that because Santos should have been able to see what happened, then it was okay for the prosecutor to reference that in the closing and call him either a snitch or a perjurer. Well, he was asked the question, did you see what happened? And he said no. I think we'd have to take his word for it. I mean, if he was there trying to help a fellow inmate, you would generally think he'd say, of course I saw it, and the guard beat him up. And the guard started it. I mean, I think that's the most, you know, it's a very truthful answer. Did you see something? No, I didn't see it. And they can't say with specificity that he should have seen it. They said that we believe he should have been able to see it where he was in light of the cameras. But again, we don't have all the video. And now, it's true that the prosecutor could have called to the jury's attention the difference in testimony as to whether he was picking up a watch or whether he was picking up a radio, and it did. And then the prosecutor could have said, you know, now you must decide, you know, based on what you're hearing. You're hearing two different versions of events, and I think that's perfectly fine if you stop at that point. But to come back and say that he's lying, or if he takes one position, he's a snitch, or if he takes the other position, he's committing perjury, is completely beyond that. And Judge, you asked the question, you know, I don't think it has to, how do we know it when we see it? I don't think we have to do the first person. I'm not sure if you're going to find a whole lot of instances where the prosecutor's going to get up. I am telling you, ladies and gentlemen, he is a liar. You know, I mean, I think prosecutors are more sophisticated than that in trying to figure a way around that. And I'm not saying this was done intentionally. I'm just saying we have to look at the record as to what was said. And in this case, what the prosecutor said goes beyond the bounds. Certainly, they could discuss his bias all day long. Certainly, they could point out differences in testimony. Radio, watch, whatever. Certainly you could say, you know, ladies and gentlemen, jury.
But you're
saying
it's inappropriate for a prosecutor to offer up any theory about why a witness may have been untruthful in their testimony. That's inappropriate.
I think
what you did is theorize that he may be lying because of this, or he may be lying because of that. That's what the prosecutor said.
When it borders on interjecting where you can read into it credibility called by the prosecutor saying you can't believe this person or this person is lying, I think that crosses the line. I'm not saying I think you can throw up a theory. You can throw up
called closing argument.
Yes.
That's where this occurred.
Correct.
argument.
Right.
And typically there's an instruction given to the jury which says that what the lawyers say is not evidence. Isn't that instruction typically given?
And it was. On page 28, one sentence, remember that any statements, objections, or argument made by the lawyer are not evidence. I agree.
All right.
Okay. There has to be a fine line. And I think the line was crossed. I think it went beyond that by saying that Mr. Santos can't tell you that Craig, that Vickers did it because he'd be a snitch, or that.
If he rats on Craig, he's a snitch.
Right. And
it was the one theory.
And if he tells you that Vickers did it, he's committing perjury. Not in the light of this case. And I think the cases say you have to look at it in the context. And you have to look at it in light of the evidence. And the evidence in this case goes to credibility, because that is the evidence in this case. Trial judge has to sit there and look at the credibility, or the jury has to sit there and listen to the witnesses and determine credibility. And the prosecutor got up and essentially said, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, Jose Santos is lying. He's lying. That he did not see this. I think that he could get up and say, look, his statements are inconsistent. He said he picked up a radio. You heard him, someone saying he picked up a watch. The video shows he was here. He was here. Draw your own conclusions. Can't say he's lying. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Claison. Your case is under submission.